Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. Ethiopians are voting in national elections expected to give the ruling IPRDF party another five-year hold on power. Voting appeared to be going smoothly Sunday in the capital of Addis Ababa, where long lines of voters waited peacefully outside polling stations. Nearly 37 million people are registered to vote in Sunday's election. Meanwhile, initial results are expected within 2 to 5 days, with official results coming by June 22nd. United Nations Chief Ban Ki-moon has condemned the killing of a Burundian opposition leader and is urging all parties to shun violence and work to resolve the country's political crisis. The Secretary General said Saturday's killing of the UPD party leader, Zedi Feruzi, threatened to entrench mistrust and trigger further violence in Burundi. In a statement, Mr. Ban urged authorities to take steps to prevent political killings and called for full participation in talks facilitated by a UN special envoy and African mediators. U.S. officials blamed Iraqi forces for Islamic State advances in the recent days, as reports emerged that the militant group had seized another border post and killed hundreds in Syria. Syrian state media says IS fighters executed at least 400 people since capturing the town of Palmyra last week. In neighboring Iraq, where the Islamic State group took control of the Ali Walid border post in the last 24 hours, military and paramilitary forces are mounting a counteroffensive against the insurgents in Anbar province. You read more on that at VOA News. This is VOA News. Malaysian authorities say police have found 30 mass graves containing the remains of people believed to be Bangladeshi or Rohingya migrants from Myanmar. The Home Minister, Zahid Hamidi, told reporters Sunday that the graves had been found along the border with Thailand near villages that had been used by human traffickers. Local media reported that the graves containing hundreds of skeletons have been found in and near detention camps used by human traffickers of Bangladeshi and Rohingya migrants. Officials had previously denied that any such mass graves or slave camps existed on Malaysian soil. A bus carrying 30 international women activists, including American feminist campaigner Gloria Steinem, crossed the border into South Korea from the north on Sunday to mark International Women's Disarmament Day. Steinem, the 81-year-old feminist pioneer, spoke to reporters in the South.
I know that we had real human exchanges with North Korean women. There is nothing like sitting in a circle and telling each other our human stories, right? And that's what happened.
The women called Women Cross the DMZ arrived in North Korea Tuesday and held a peace symposium and marched with North Korean women during their six-day visit. Although she would not comment on the state of human rights in North Korea, Steinem told the media that a breach of human rights anywhere is a breach of human rights everywhere. Spain is holding regional and local elections Sunday. It's a vote that could see the country revamp its political landscape. Parties fueled by the anti-austerity movement are hoping to challenge the country's two-party system and dampen Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy and his ruling Conservative Popular Party's prospects of winning a second term later this year. The captors of a former Pakistani prime minister's son demanded the release of several al-Qaeda prisoners in exchange for his release, according to the former premier Sunday. Yusuf Raza Gilani said he had spoken by phone for 8 minutes to his son, Ali Haider, who is believed being held somewhere in Afghanistan. Gunmen seized Haider in May of 2013, and in a video later released reportedly by the Taliban that the militants claimed to be holding him hostage. Nigerian cell phone providers, leading cell phone provider, says it urgently needs diesel to prevent shutting down services across Africa's biggest oil producer. A months-long fuel shortage already has grounded many aircraft and vehicles and silenced some radio stations. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
The government has urged the police and justice to quickly do investigations in order to know who has done this and bring those criminals into justice.
Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza demands an investigation into the assassination of an opposition leader.
There are really regular intercourses between those of us who are in Uganda and in the government with the Ugandan diaspora. We do value their views.
Ugandan Prime Minister Ruhakana Rugunda is in Washington, D.C. to interact with citizens and senior U.S. State Department officials.
The lack of transparency, the exclusion of poor people from the decision-making process, gender injustices, all of these, I think, combine to really create this edifice of inequality across the continent.
And the 25th edition of the World Economic Forum on Africa will convene in Cape Town, South Africa next week. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza has called for an investigation into the assassination of Zedi Feruzi, leader of the Opposition Union for Peace and Development, UPD. Some opposition parties and civil society groups blame Mr. Nkurunziza for the opposition leader's murder. But presidential spokesman Willie Nyamitwe told me earlier that the president and his ruling CNDD-FDD party are not responsible for the opposition leader's death.
What you have to know is that the government has condemned this crime because this opposition leader was protected by a bodyguard from the government because he expressed that his concern about his security, and the government has provided to him bodyguards. But he has been killed, and with him, a bodyguard and the two others have been injured and are now treated at the hospital. So what we have to say is that the government has urged the police and justice to quickly do investigations in order to know who has done this and bring those criminals into justice.
Some opposition leaders and some Burundians are accusing the government, and particularly President Pierre Nkurunziza, for causing this because of the tension in the country and because of the protest. What do you say to that?
The tension is brought in by those demonstrators and the plotters, not from the ruling party or the President Pierre Nkurunziza, because we do believe that it's the right for the ruling party and its members to appoint who they want to, as long as they don't violate the laws and the constitution of Burundi, to be their candidate at the presidential of 2015. But some activists from the civil society and the opposition leaders have called the population to go into the streets, and those came out with violence. They've been killing people, burning cars, burning houses, destroying everything they find in the streets, and even barricading roads, violating rights from the other citizens to go for their lives. So this means that those bringing insecurity in the country are not people from the ruling party or from the government, but those from the civil society organizations and from the opposition parties.
How does the government intend to end this tension that some people say that has contributed to the death of this opposition leader?
Let me emphasize one thing. This opposition leader has been killed in one of the suburbs where these demonstrations are happening. A suburb where the police and the government, they don't have access freely. So because people are barricading roads and they don't allow policemen to go inside. So if this crime happened in that area, how can people come and accuse the government or claim that it's the ruling party or someone else? I think we have to wait for investigations to be made, but we have to emphasize that this happened in an area 100% controlled by demonstrators and the opposition leaders.
Tanzanian Minister of East Africa, as well as the General Secretary of the East Africa Community, are in the country holding consultations. When they met with officials of the government and the ruling party, what was the discussion?
The discussion was about how people can move forward to elections. Because we do have to go to elections. We need elections. Our institutions that have been voted, elected by the population, have to be replaced by others elected by the population. So time is running out, and we have to quickly go to elections. But we see that some politicians here from the opposition parties don't need to go to elections and are looking for some pretext in order to delay. But the government is still waiting for them to campaign, because now rallies are going on, and we do want all the stakeholders to go for rallies and to campaign in order to participate to the elections. This is what is happening. It's a kind of political dialogue that is held by government and civil society and the opposition, and with the assistance of the UN here, the AU officials, and the EAC officials.
What has the president particularly said about this assassination of this opposition leader?
He is very concerned by what is happening in the country, and he's appealing all the population to remain calm, to remain peaceful, and to continue campaigning, but respecting others' lives. So this is what he is saying, and he urges all the security forces and the justice to quickly do the necessary investigations in order to find out what happened and who are the killers, in order for them to be sought for justice.
Willy Nyamitwe is a spokesman for Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza. He spoke with me from the capital, Bujumbura. Meanwhile, Ugandan Prime Minister Ruhakana Rugunda says his country is working with other regional leaders to find a solution to the crisis in Burundi. Dr. Rugunda is currently in Washington to meet with senior officials at the U.S. State Department and plans to interact with Ugandans. He told me that Uganda has created the enabling environment for investors in an effort to create jobs for the youth, as well as improve the living conditions of citizens.
I'm here to essentially meet Ugandan communities in some few places within the United States, mainly in Washington, in Minneapolis.
So what is the objective?
Well, there are really regular intercourses between those of us who are in Uganda and in the government. With the Ugandan diaspora, we do value their views, their inputs, and we exchange views because we are faced with a common destiny to ensure that we develop our country and develop our region.
Mr. Prime Minister, what would you tell people that will be interested in investment opportunities in Uganda?
The investment opportunities in Uganda are enormous. There is a lot of opportunities in agriculture, especially agro-processing, tourism, infrastructure development, especially construction, and hydropower generation, and even solar power generation and other forms of energy. So opportunities are numerous, and I call on all those who intend to invest and make big money to come to Uganda.
Talking about investment opportunities, then people talk about peace and security. Uganda has been relatively peaceful among the East African countries who have been suffering despite recent attempts by neighboring Somali insurgent group to attack the country. What is your government doing in order to ensure the protection of citizens as well as the protection of investors facing a possible threat or attack by these militant groups?
Well, as you know, for the last 10 years, Uganda has been a very peaceful country, and this has opened many opportunities for investments. We take peace and security as prerequisites for any meaningful development or progress in any country. So investors to Uganda are assured of security in Uganda.
Now, talking about security, neighboring Burundi is at a crossroad at the moment. Uganda has been playing a critical role in this neighboring country to help ensure peace and security. So the U.S. has called on countries in the region, such as yours, that has played significant roles in other countries in the region to help in this regard. What is your government response to this call?
Uganda has traditionally played a very constructive and active role in peace and security in the region, and actually Burundi in particular. As you know, President Museveni has been the regional chair of the peace process in Burundi, and Uganda therefore continues to play an important role in ensuring that the people of Burundi are able and do manage their security situation well, so that peace and security can prevail in the country and issues can be resolved across the table other than other methods that would involve greater conflict.
Looking at the current situation on the ground, what is the relationship between Kampala and Bujumbura at the moment?
The relations between Kampala and Bujumbura is good. The Burundi and the people of Uganda live in peace. They do significant amount of trade. So relations between the two countries are good relations.
What about the relations between Kampala and Washington? You are here. I know you are having a series of meetings with the top leadership of the U.S., among other issues. What are you discussing?
Well, it is true that relations between the United States of America and Uganda is definitely good, and it's true that we have had good and cordial discussions with senior officials of State Department, and this was really consolidating the already warm relations between our two countries. We have worked together on various programs, and we expect even broader scope of cooperation between the United States and Uganda, and between the United States and the region.
Ruhakana Rugunda is the Ugandan Prime Minister. He spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. Former Zimbabwean Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai is warning of an outbreak of chaos because of the country's deteriorating economic outlook. He told Blessing Zulu of VOA's Zimbabwe service that citizens must come together before the situation worsens.
The state of the economy definitely needs attention urgently. In fact, we need a state of emergency to address the myriad of problems that the economy is facing. It cannot be treated as business as usual. This laissez-faire approach by government is not going to resolve the issue. The real fundamental problem is that this economy needs fundamental reforms. And unfortunately, ZANU-PF's priority is to, instead of reforming, they only look at control. And that kind of an attitude does not unleash the economic potential of the country. So I think you need both political and economic reforms to address the lack of confidence in the economy that we are facing.
But when you say there's an urgent need to reform and for a sort of a state of emergency to address the issue, how should the government go about doing this?
Well, first of all, they have to change policy on a number of policy constraints. You cannot have 80% of your revenues going to wages and salaries. You cannot have an indigenization policy which is affecting confidence from outside when you need foreign direct investment. You need to deal with corruption and the rule of law issues. You need to engage the international community so that you're able to deal with your debt burden, debt overhang that we have in the economy. So there are a number of policy measures, and definitely to change the governance culture in the country is a priority.
But it appears Mr. Mugabe's government is showing no signs of reform. How is this going to end?
Well, they are leaping from one crisis to the other. And unfortunately, you can't buy a crisis off. A crisis will lead to another crisis and eventual collapse. I can tell you that in their preoccupation with political, intra-political fights, no one is paying attention to the erosion of the economic well-being of the people. And eventually, people cannot just watch. And that's the most dangerous thing. It will cause instability in the country.
Let's turn to your recent trip to Germany. Tell us about your visit.
Well, my visit to Germany was a diplomatic invitation. And I went to Germany with a delegation to engage various sectors of the German society, the government, civil society, even some of the, I had a meeting with one of the state governors, you know. It was quite wide-ranging, and I think the engagement led to a better understanding of where the crisis is, not only the crisis of the country, but also the situation in the political, in the MDC. And the political situation in Zambia, they want to send a delegation to Zimbabwe, which is coming in the next week, and a business delegation, that is. And we had a wide-ranging engagement.
Morgan Tsvangirai is a former Zimbabwean prime minister. He spoke with Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe service from the capital, Harare. The 25th World Economic Forum on Africa will convene in Cape Town, South Africa next week. Regional and global leaders from business, government, and civil society will take stock of progress over the last 25 years. High on the agenda will be sustainable development, poverty, and economic inequality. Dr. Nick Galasso is a senior researcher at Oxfam America. My colleague Douglas Impuga asked him about the seriousness of the economic inequality in Africa.
I think that it's a dire issue, and it's an issue that we have to take very seriously if our objective is to eliminate extreme poverty. You know, it's been shown for many decades now that there's a strong link between high extreme inequality and progress in terms of reducing global poverty. The sub-Saharan African continent has seen some of the fastest growing economies in the last decades, but that growth hasn't translated into reducing poverty in ways that we like to see. So I think that if we care about eradicating extreme poverty, we have to take extreme inequality seriously. And if I could just give you a quick example of the importance that the income distribution within a country has on the life chances of a country's people, you know, if you compare Bangladesh and Nigeria, they have about the same average incomes. Nigeria is only slightly richer, but it's far less equal. And the result is that a child who is born in Nigeria is three times more likely to die before their fifth birthday than a child born in Bangladesh.
Africa is also the world's second most inequitable region after Latin America. Has this got to do with Africa starting off as having a number of people so poor, or what do you think accounts for that?
When we talk about the causes or the sources of inequality in Africa, I think that first and foremost, you know, you have to address and think about the context, particularly the legacy of colonialism, and particularly how political systems in Africa, they really just replaced the colonial overlords that were there, right? So they kind of replaced these structures. But I think in more proximate terms, we have to think about, you know, how unfair tax systems are across African countries. We see that poor people tend to pay more in taxes than the rich, and the amount of revenues that are foregone because of generous tax incentives to big corporations, which places more burdens on the poor. Related, we can talk about, you know, the extent of illicit financial flows that are just flying out of the continent as well. I just saw one statistic that said that about nearly 6% of the combined GDP of sub-Saharan Africa, that equivalent is lost in financial flows. The types of unfair distribution of investment that sometimes breaks down to identity politics. So you have networks of patronage that when certain groups become in power, they benefit their people as opposed to others, which leads to, you know, unfair access to services and the like. We can talk about conflict in the continent, but also I think the deficit of good governance that we see and the lack of really equal political representation, the lack of transparency, the exclusion of poor people from the decision-making process, gender injustices, all of these, I think, combine to really create this edifice of inequality across the continent.
Are the governments or the people in power in those countries aware of this crisis?
I think so. You can't go to, a place like Kenya and see the grave inequality between places like Nairobi and then other more rural places. So I think that leaders are aware of the grave inequality, but I think that in a lot of ways it boils down to a question of political will and political opportunity to do something about it.
Nick Galasso is a senior researcher at Oxfam America. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from Washington. Trade analysts predict South Sudan will export about 4 million barrels of DAP blend crude oil in June. That will be down more than 9% from May. The head of Parliament Energy and Mining Committee says such fluctuations in oil production are normal, adding that technical adjustments being made in Upper Nile State could soon reverse the trend. For VOA, Philip Thorne Aliu has more from the capital, Juba.
The National Assembly Energy and Mining Committee Chairman, Garwij Lam, says daily oil production will be down by less than 1% from the current 168,000 barrels produced per day, and insists that is not because of the ongoing fighting.
It has only reduced to 163,000 barrels per day. The reason is not because of the shutdown of the course of the fight, simply because of technical arrangement within the company in Fallujah. So there's no any threat to the oil field.
Lam says these kinds of fluctuations in oil production are not new for South Sudan or any oil producing region. South Sudan is expected to export 4 million barrels in June compared to 4.4 million in May, according to trade sources. Oil fields in Unity State have remained closed since being shut down when rebels took control of the region in December 2013. The government says it now controls the oil fields in Unity State and production will resume soon. Lam says despite the increased fighting in parts of the oil-producing states of Unity and Upper Nile, there is some good news for South Sudan's oil sales.
The oil living prices in the global market has also increased to $64 per barrel, which is also another encouraging news to the oil production.
But Lam acknowledges that South Sudan economy, which relies almost entirely on oil revenue, has been significantly hampered by the conflict in the oil-producing states.
It has affected the resource envelope of the government. So there is a gap created by the shutdown of this. But this morning I was listening to the minister that now they are working to resume work on Tarja's site, which is the Espok company, which is operating there.
Lam says resuming maximum production of oil in Unity requires adequate security for its oil workers. The uptick in fighting in Unity and Upper Nile states is largely blamed for the overall drop in oil production. For BOA News, I am Philip Thonaleu in Juba.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, despite a failed coup attempt, Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza remains steadfast in his plans to run for a third term. Demonstrators say he has had his chance. Regional leaders want the June 26 election postponed until the nation is stable. Join us on Wednesday at 18:30 UTC for an in-depth discussion on Burundi. That's right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. This is James Butte, host of Voice of America's Daybreak Africa. Join me Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC for the latest in Africa news, features, and sports. We are also available on the internet at www.voaafrica.com. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show on the Voice of America.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Nigeria and join Segun Adeyemi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Peter, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, May 24th. Second round, first leg matches have been played across Africa this weekend in the qualifying series for the 2015 CAF Under 23 Championship. This tournament is important because the top three teams in the finals to be played in Senegal we qualify for the 2016 Olympics in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. In the matches played so far this weekend, only Ghana, Uganda, and Tunisia recorded victories. Ghana defeated visiting Congo 1-0, the same scoreline by which host Tunisia beat Sudan, while Uganda traveled to Rwanda to beat the home team 2-1. Two other matches, Mauritania versus Mali and Botswana versus Zambia, we are drawn by identical score of 1-1. Two more matches will be played today, Sunday. Return leg matches are slated for next weekend. At the conclusion of another home and away round of matches in the third round, the seven aggregate winners will join host Senegal in the eighth nation final of the CAF Under 23 Championship to be played from December 5th to 19th. Staying with African football, Liberia can host international soccer matches again, so says African soccer's governing body, CAF, after Liberia was declared free of the deadly Ebola virus. CAF, however, said Guinea and Sierra Leone remain barred for the same reason of the Ebola epidemic. The decision to lift the ban on playing international matches in Liberia comes just weeks before the start of the 2017 African Nations Cup qualifiers. Liberia's first home qualifier is scheduled for September against Tunisia. Guinea and Sierra Leone will still be forced to play their home games outside of their respective countries, with new cases of the virus still being discovered. Morocco has agreed to stage the home qualifiers of Guinea, but the plans of Sierra Leone are yet unknown. In more African football news, Frenchman Hervé Renard has stepped down as coach of African champion Ivory Coast. In February, the charismatic 46-year-old led the Elephants to their first African title since 1992. Renard is now tipped to take over at French top league side Lille. Let's now turn to athletics. Kenya's Gladys Cherono smashed the course record at the 10-kilometer IAAF Gold Label race in Ottawa, Canada, on Saturday. Cherono's personal best of 30 minutes 56 seconds on a windy night was good enough to eclipse a record of 31 minutes 21 seconds set by fellow Kenyan Mary Keitani a year ago. The victory fed Cherono the $8,000 prize money plus $2,000 for the course record and another $2,000 for being the first athlete, male or female, to cross the finish line in a special gender challenge. The women were given a head start of 3 minutes and 25 seconds, and no one ever caught up with Cherono. In the men's race, the 2009 course record set by Ethiopia's Deriba Maga, which is 27 minutes and 24 seconds, was never challenged. Kenya's Nicholas Bor won in 27 minutes and 55 seconds, 2 seconds ahead of compatriot Simon Cheprot, who finished second. Staying with athletics, course records also fell at another event on Saturday, a half marathon in the Czech Republic. Elijah Tirop Siren led the Kenyan quartet to victory and took 20 seconds off the course record to win the men's title. Siren broke away from the leading group with 4 kilometers left to achieve what he described as the best win of his career in 61 minutes and 1 second. In the women's race, Mulu Seboka of Ethiopia won in 69 minutes and 11 seconds for a personal best and a course record by 6 seconds. Finally, the stage is set for the FIFA presidential election, scheduled for Friday, May 29th. The election is being contested by two candidates, incumbent Sepp Blatter, who is 79 years old, and challenger Prince Ali bin Al Hussein of Jordan, who is 40 years younger than Blatter. Two other candidates, Luis Figo of Portugal and Michael van Praag of the Netherlands, have withdrawn from the race. Analysts have tipped Blatter to retain the presidency, which he first assumed in 1998. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Peter Klote in Washington.
Thanks a lot, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. We'll be right back.
sana sibusi mitigai asije kwa namuni kapandisha mboga na ukifika wagize chai savana takila usipe kisoga kusoma vazi kimine fai tupia pendezi ala za kimoga.
Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's Roman's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Last week, Al-Shabaab, an affiliate of Al-Qaeda, the terrorist group with a global reach, demonstrates its threat to the Horn of Africa. In Kenya, at the border town between Somalia and Kenya, Al-Shabaab operatives entered a mosque and harangued frightened Kenyans for the evening prayer. After 3 hours, they requested them to go home and have a good night's sleep. No one was injured. Their purpose was to demonstrate that they could enter Kenya and perpetrate crimes if they so wish. At the end of the week, Al-Shabaab militia hoisted the black flag of the caliphate, but at that time, they were confronted with Kenya security personnel. There were exchange of fires. They withdrew. There was no report of casualties. In Somalia itself, ex-combatants of Al-Shabaab who were defected to the government side were interviewed and were asked to tell what life is behind the lines with Al-Shabaab. The consensus among these defectors was that although UNISOM, the UN-backed peacekeeping force of the African Union, had succeeded in pushing Al-Shabaab out of major towns and cities, they are still strong in the countryside. And they suggested that it would not be possible for them to be defeated by force of arms. The representative of the Secretary General of the United Nations to Somalia also gave a realistic picture of the security threat of Al-Shabaab to Somalia. He too suggested that though they have been pushed out of Mogadishu and major cities and towns, they have not been completely defeated in the countryside. In his remarks, he also suggested that elections were being contemplated. This should be a very good idea. It is time that the Somali people themselves elect their representatives to parliament and their presidents. Chances are that they would be better prepared to defend the elected representatives when they do the election, rather have it done by clan politics, which is now the situation. There is also the problem in Kenya and Burundi. The president of Burundi perhaps trying to deflect attention from his decision to go for a third time, suggested last week that the threat to Burundi was now Al-Shabaab because of the support they gave to Somalia in the peacekeeping force. The Al-Shabaab immediately issued a statement that it had no intention to attack Burundi. But in Kenya, there are prominent voices being raised that the government should withdraw its troops from UNISOM in Somalia, since this was the reason given of Al-Shabaab for its attack on Kenya. The representatives of governments in Somalia are also suggesting that the United Nations might be willing to take on the full peacekeeping role in Somalia. Now, it is important to bear in mind that the spread or increase of United Nations peacekeeping in Africa is worrisome to many Africans. In the Great Lake regions and the Democratic Republic of the Congo, questions have been raised as to whether it is counterproductive or not to have UN peacekeeping. In fact, the president of the Congo, the Republic of the Congo, had called for the withdrawal of the UN force, and Rwanda has openly questioned the usefulness of United Nations peacekeeping forces. So this has to be kept in mind. But if, because of their consequences, such as lack of finance and logistics by the regional forces, one needs to have a UN peacekeeping force in Africa, then the Secretary General must be prepared to undertake real reform of the peacekeeping department in the UN Secretariat. The DPKO, as it is called, has now been held by France since mid-1995, when Kofi Annan was first elected as Secretary General. The circumstances in which France acquired this plum job should be left for another occasion. But the inheritance of post is a troublesome one. And in this reform, not only DPKO, but the political and humanitarian jobs should be reviewed. It would be preferable if these three departments are headed not by permanent members of the Security Council, but by small or medium-sized states. If this is done, then the United Nations could play a very effective role in the maintenance of peace and security in the African continent. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, sports editor Segun Adeyemi, and our engineer for today, Nick Ivanov, we say thanks for joining us. And as the elders say, family is like music. Some high notes, some low notes, but always a beautiful song. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
Like many nations, the United States pauses each year to honor those who died in its defense through military service. The custom is an ancient one, recalling a speech by the Athenian statesman Pericles that the casualties of war are worthy men, and the living need not have a more heroic spirit. On Monday, May 25th, Memorial Day, in communities across America, there will be speeches striking similar themes, and a moment of silence will be observed. Like the poppies in Flanders Fields, small flags will be seen among the graves in the nation's many military cemeteries, and the families of the fallen will stop to remember. Beyond mere ceremony, the day represents a debt paid by the living to those Americans who made the ultimate sacrifice to ensure their country's freedom. Some died in battle, some of disease. Others were lost in foreign prisons and never returned. Most died very young, defending their nation's ideals and liberties, perhaps even before they had much of a chance to fully appreciate them. Hundreds of thousands died fighting to make others free too, in North Africa, Europe, the Pacific, Asia, and the Middle East. Memorial Day honors no single battle or war. Its meaning transcends heroic monuments. Rather, it is the recognition by a grateful nation that lives and blood lost in defense of its freedoms are never given in vain.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.